Welcome, everybody. This is the fifth lecture of the Anatomy of the Fed course for Mises Academy. This is happening on July 23rd, 2012, and this lecture is itself called Anatomy of the Fed because in this particular lecture, what we're doing is literally going through the structure of the Federal Reserve, meaning what are its components and how does the thing actually work in practice as far as its organizational structure. And then near the end of the lecture, I'll show you how, if you were curious and wanted to actually go to the Fed's balance sheet and look at it. And then next week, we're going to actually get into conventional Fed operations. The following week, we're going to look at unconventional Fed operations, and that is when we're going to deal with things like quantitative easing, operation twist, stuff like that. And possibly, we might talk about that LIBOR stuff. Not that that's about the Fed per se, but since that's kind of a big deal right now, presumably if you're taking this class, you might care about that kind of thing. So just a reminder, or two things. One is when I open up this room, I was changing, you know, it automatically brings up what you called it last week, and I didn't delete far enough. So this is labeled Anatomy of the Fed Lecture 45. If you're looking this thing up after the fact, obviously this is actually Lecture 5. And last thing is, remember, there's a lot of you logged in right now, so if you have a question you want me to catch at the end, don't put it in the chat box because that thing flies too furiously. Put it in the Q&A devoted box. Okay, so let's go ahead and get started here. So the actual structure of the Federal Reserve, you can take this pretty deeply if you want to. Where I'm going to take it deep enough so that, first of all, you get a basic cursory understanding, but also enough so that we can see where does the true power reside. And you'll, if you don't know what I'm alluding to, you'll see on this issue of who controls the Fed and who's the decision makers. Once you understand the constituents of the Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC, because that's the actual voting body that decides Fed policy, once you see how those people get to be there, you'll see that the power really is concentrated in Washington. Okay, so the Board of Governors, I'm just going to read off these PowerPoint notes here. So it's created by, hang on, let me activate the pencil. Created by the Banking Act of 1935, so notice I'm saying not in 1913. So the Federal Reserve Act was 1913. It's a long story, but what happened is originally the Federal Reserve was more federal than it is now, in the sense meaning it was decentralized. And remember, that's partly why they put that word in there. That some people were saying, hey, we're modeling it after the Bank of England or the Bank of France or the Bundesbank. Why don't we just call this thing the Bank of the United States or something like that, the Bank of America, you know, to show that this is the central bank. And the people who were at Jekyll Island realized that, or someone made the point and it carried the day, that no, because the American public is very suspicious of centralized power, more so than the citizens in other countries, or in European countries at least, and so we don't want to call it that. We don't want them thinking that this is an arm of Wall Street that's going to be used to club the smaller banks that are spread throughout the country. We want to foster this illusion that this is a decentralized system that's just there for regulating and keeping things on an even keel. We don't want it to look like it's the central behemoth. So the original Federal Reserve Act did distribute the power more uniformly around the country, and then it was in the Banking Act of 1935 that reorganized the Fed, and it concentrated the power in Washington. So one thing you'll notice is, originally, I don't believe that anything I've assigned to you guys is mandatory reading in this class, that it would necessarily come up in that kind of stuff, but if you read about the history of the Federal Reserve, you'll notice that up front, in the early years, the guy was not the head of you know, wasn't a guy who sat in Washington. He wasn't the chairman of the Federal Reserve the way Ben Bernanke is now. No, the important guy originally was the head of the New York Federal District Bank. Okay, so, you know, in our times, remember, that's what Timothy Geithner was back in 2008 when, you know, all of everything was going crazy. Ben Bernanke was the chair of the Fed, and Geithner was the head of the New York Fed. So it's still true that the head of the New York Fed is extremely powerful because that is the district Fed branch that oversees Wall Street. So obviously, that guy's got a lot more clout and influence and can broker deals and can do favors for super powerful people compared to the guy who's in charge of, like, the St. Louis branch. But the point is, the head of the New York Fed is not as powerful today as Ben Bernanke is, right? So that's so what I'm saying. But back in the day, originally, it was this guy Benjamin Strong, which that's just kind of funny. I don't know if you guys watch The Daily Show. You can see with this LIBOR scandal, there one of the guys who's really, you know, was caught doing a lot of stuff. His name is Richie Rich. And then his boss was, you know, Diamond, Jamie Diamond. So it was, anyway, the guy who was in charge of the Fed, ran the Fed with an iron hand, originally was this guy whose last name was Strong. So it's kind of funny. But anyway, if you read about the operation of the Federal Reserve in its early years, this guy Strong is going to come up all the time. And he was not what Bernanke is now. Instead, he was the head of the New York Fed because at the time, that was where the true power was. And so part of what happened, and just in general with the New Deal era, Roosevelt engineered things to centralize power in Washington, D.C. and take it away from the states and even concentrate it in the executive branch, right? So Roosevelt famously went head-to-head with the Supreme Court, and I know there's a lot of foreign students tuned into this class. So originally the Supreme Court of the United States was throwing out major components of the New Deal, which was Roosevelt's signature legislation that was greatly expanding the scope of what the federal government could do. And the Supreme Court was throwing it out, you know, large pieces of it, saying that's unconstitutional. The federal government didn't have the power to do that. And so then Roosevelt threatened the so-called pack the courts and to add more justices, right? So he couldn't just, like, fire them because that was supposed to be a division of power. But he was arguing there's nothing in the Constitution that says I can't put more justices on the court and dilute these guys who are sitting there right now that are voting against my New Deal. And the court didn't want him to do that because they realized we would be forever destroyed, so they backed off. So from that point forward, you know, the crisis was averted. Roosevelt backed down and didn't add more justices. But then coincidentally, from that point forward, the Supreme Court all of a sudden saw the Constitution as a living document that actually did kind of implicitly have all these powers for the federal government to do all the stuff that Roosevelt wants to do. All right, so if you're cynical, you're going to think that's not that the justices just looked again and said, oh my gosh, my legal views have changed. It was they realized Roosevelt's really popular right now. The public likes the New Deal. If we go head-to-head against him with this, we might lose. And so let's not destroy the court's power forever by having this precedent where the president can just add more justices if he doesn't like the way we ruled on something. And so they realize we got to kind of roll over and give him what he wants on the New Deal. So anyway, I'm just giving you the context here. In the 30s, there was a radical shift in the understanding of what the U.S. federal government could do and what its powers were relative to the states and the individual. And so it's not surprising that at this time, too, one of the things they did when they were reforming the banking system was to take power away from the regional Fed branches or districts, whatever you want to call them, and concentrate that power in Washington. And so one of the things, it's just nomenclature, but just to underscore this, is that the district heads used to be called governors. But now, after the 1935 reorganization, they were called president. And in banker world, in banker jargon, a governor is a more prestigious title than a president. And so that's why, you know, we're talking about the Board of Governors sits in Washington. And so that's where the true power is now, because in terms of banking, the Board of Governors are the people that are really running the show. And now the people in charge of the district branches are just called presidents. So, you know, so-and-so is the president of the St. Louis Fed, or the president of the San Francisco Fed, as opposed to before they would have been called governors. All right, so that's just a little bit of lore there. And then they also took power away from New York. Because like I said before, this guy Benjamin Strong was the dominant force running effectively the Federal Reserve, and he was the New York Fed president. And then he died, I think, like 27, 28, something like that. And then there was a power vacuum, and this is where Milton Friedman comes in and says, and that's why the Great Depression happened, because Benjamin Strong wasn't around to inflate like he should have, and that's why we had the 29 stock market crash. Okay. But anyway, the point is, for our purposes here, I just want you to realize the Fed was set up in a more decentralized manner originally, and then during the New Deal, they centralized it and took power and put it in Washington. Another little just tidbit, back when I was doing research for my book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression and the New Deal, it was interesting. You really saw the distinction between these two eras, because when you're looking at, like when you ask the question, hey, what was the Fed's interest rate policy in the 1920s? And I realized there was no such thing. It wasn't that the Fed set the benchmark interest rate in the 20s the way nowadays you could say, oh, what did the Fed set as its target interest rate? Because in the 20s, what you would say is, well, each Federal Reserve Bank had its own discount rate. And they weren't always, many times they were the same, but they weren't always the same. All right. And so what I had to decide if I want to talk about the, you know, what was the Fed doing with interest rates in the 20s, because I was, of course, telling the story from an Austrian point of view, that the Fed helped fuel the stock market bubble that then burst in 1929. To be able to tell that story, I needed to point to what's the Fed policy, and the point was there was no such thing. And so what I ended up doing was looking at the New York Fed's policy, saying, well, that's clearly going to be relevant for a stock bubble, is what was the New York Fed doing. But my point is that's how decentralized it was, that it's hard that there you know, each Fed technically had its own policy-making powers back then, whereas now it doesn't even occur to us to say what's the federal funds rate that the St. Louis Fed is setting and what's the one that the New York Fed's setting, and is that higher or lower than what the San Fran Fed is doing. That would be a nonsense statement. Okay, back to the PowerPoint slide here. So the Board of Governors is where the power resides, but don't get confused. The Board of Governors is not the same thing as the FOMC. So there are more people who have a say in Fed policy than the Board of Governors, but as we'll see, the Board of Governors is really strong because they can influence who the people are that are also on the FOMC that vote with these guys or gals. Okay, but the Board of Governors is, what is it? 7 members, they serve 14-year terms. So of the 7 members who are on the Board of Governors, a chair and vice chair are picked with 4-year renewable terms. And you'll see I have Greenspan with a question mark. And unfortunately, I wrote this slide last year for when I taught, you know, this was the introductory session of this course, and I can't remember right now what little historical curiosity I wanted to add. And there's something about Greenspan's tenure as Fed chief that these bullet points made me think there was anomalous, and I explained at the time, but I can't remember right now what needed to be explained. So if any of you are confused by these bullet points and you're thinking, wait a minute, how does that work for Alan Greenspan, I can tell you But you first have to explain what the apparent problem is, because right now I can't even remember what the issue was. Okay, so, and this is important for this issue of who controls the Fed. Is the Fed a private organization, or is it a government entity? Well, the President of the United States appoints the Fed chair, and the Senate confirms. Okay, so that's, it's not like Walmart. The President of the United States doesn't pick the CEO of Walmart, and the Senate confirms them or denies it. So that's one major difference. Technically, the Board of Governors is the seat of the Fed's regulatory authority, but in practice, they can delegate that stuff to the reserve banks. Okay, so remember, we think about the Fed as buying and selling assets and setting the target interest rate and setting the discount rate and stuff like that. But the Fed actually is the chief regulator of the nation's banking system. So there's all kinds of stuff that the Fed has the power to do, and they do set all kinds of standards and things like that. And so what this bullet point is getting across is that technically that power by statute resides with the Board of Governors, not with the FOMC. But the Board of Governors in practice is not like those seven guys sit there and drive up to Citibank and say, let me open up the vault and let me look and make sure you have enough reserves. They, in practice, delegate to the reserve banks and then say, you make sure that the banks in your jurisdiction are complying with these regulations, or technically, they fall under your jurisdiction, so you deal with them. Okay. And then I'd say here they dominate the district banks, and we'll see in a minute why I'm saying that. Okay, the district banks. So there's 12 of them, and this map shows you the distribution. So you can see that they're concentrated in the Northeast, by which I just mean look at how many of them happen to be in the Northeast part of the U.S. compared to out here. There's barely any of them. And so this, it's partly politics, but also just acknowledging reality that there's a lot more financial commercial activity going on in the Northeast compared to the rest of the country, where there's not that much population, even relatively speaking. So that's why it looks like this. And so you may hear news stories about, oh, the president of the such and such Fed, the president of the Dallas Fed said such and such, and he disagrees with what the current Federal Open Market Committee did, or he was the dissenting vote, or the Atlanta Fed, da 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 da. So the St. Louis Federal Reserve, for example, is the one that houses that really cool website with all the data. That is my first choice when I have to go get data from something that involves government-approved numbers. I go to the St. Louis Fed, and they call it FRED. So that's maintained by the St. Louis District Bank. It's not maintained by the guys in Washington. So just an example to show these names. So you'll notice that there are different personalities associated with different banks, and some of them are actually, I mean, I don't know enough to know how much of it is just pure posturing, but some of them say pretty reasonable things from an Austrian perspective. I mean, they're not extreme libertarians saying the Fed should be abolished, but they'll say stuff like, I think that Federal Reserve policy has been too accommodative lately, and that's just going to fuel asset prices, and that the real problems are structural. And so they say a lot of stuff disagreeing with what the FOMC is doing. And so, if they happen to be voting, part of the voting block, then oftentimes they'll dissent or they won't vote at all, or that kind of stuff. Incidentally, just to give you some context, during this crisis, there has been more dissent than happened under the Greenspan years. And I've seen some people say that that's a reflection just of personality, that Greenspan wanted there to be unanimity with respect to the public. So he didn't want the public thinking that behind closed doors, Greenspan and five other guys thought one thing, and three people thought something else. He wanted there to be a united front and didn't want there to be any dissent. Whereas Bernanke, apparently, not that I know the guy personally, but people describe Bernanke as being more of a consensus builder, and he'll go in and, you know, go around the table and say, what do you guys think? And listen to everybody and then say, okay, here's what I think, and if somebody dissents, he can go and say that to a reporter and not get his head bitten off, you know, whereas apparently Greenspan didn't want you going off and bad-mouthing him to the press. So what I'm saying is, for sure, objectively, you will see Fed presidents, presidents of Federal Reserve District banks, going to reporters or writing op-eds in the Wall Street Journal or whatever for Business Week or whatever, disagreeing with what the Fed is doing. I mean, they'll do it very diplomatically, or they'll say, it's not necessarily they'll disagree and I think interest rates right now should be higher, but they might say something like, I disagree with the latest Fed statement that said we're going to keep interest rates at extraordinarily low levels for an extended period. I wouldn't have said that. I would have said through 2012. Or, I mean, it's a little nuanced dings to what the official statement was that the Fed just gave after its previous meeting. Guys will go to the and gals will go to the press now and disagree, whereas that didn't happen during the Greenspan era, and just you just didn't see that. And so I don't, like I said, so one explanation is just the difference in personalities. Another explanation, though, could just be what the Fed's doing now is pretty radical, whereas under Greenspan, everything seemed fine. And he was just doing textbook stuff, if you believe in sort of new Keynesian policy and think that there's a role for the Federal Reserve to regulate the business cycle. Greenspan kind of did what you're supposed to do. And, yep, there's a recession, you lower interest rates until things turn around, and then when prices start getting out of hand, you raise interest rates. Great. And that's what Greenspan was doing, and price inflation was fairly tame by central bank standards, and the U.S. seemed like it was chugging along, and okay, great. So it's possible, too, that the reason there wasn't dissent under Greenspan is everyone kind of thought this is fine, whereas now the economy's miserable. Under Bernanke, the Fed has been doing crazy stuff. I mean, it's clearly out-of-the-box things that the Fed has never done before, so maybe it's not so surprising that some people are thinking, I'm not so sure about this, and that they're actually going to the press and talking about it. Okay. So the district banks now. So as that slide had shown, there's 12 of them concentrated in the Northeast. So here now, the only reason I'm getting into this level of detail is because I want you to see how powerful the Board of Governors is. That's so it's, I mean, there may be a question on the multiple choice quiz for this week about this stuff just to make sure you read it and you understand it. But it's not like I'm lamenting at night that the general public doesn't know about these Class A, B, and C voting blocks, and that's not the issue. The reason it's important to get this is so you see how powerful the Board of Governors actually is. Okay, so each district bank, remember the 12 of them, you know, one in New York, St. Louis, San Fran, that kind of, so each of those, that's what we're talking about in this slide, has 9 board members, and they're evenly split among Class A, B, and C. So that means, of course, each of these 12 banks has 3 Class A board members, 3 Class B board members, and 3 Class C ones. Okay, so now in this next bullet point, where do these board members come from? Well, the large, medium, and small member banks, so a member bank means within the jurisdiction of these district banks, a member bank is a commercial bank, you know, so in the private sector, that is a member of that particular district bank. So if you're a commercial bank in the St. Louis area, you have to decide, am I going to be a member of the St. Louis Federal Reserve District Bank or not? And so what I'm saying is, if you are a member of your regional Fed district, then you become eligible to elect the board members for that district bank, but it's based on your size. And so if you're a small member bank, so you're a relatively small commercial bank and you're part of, let's say, the St. Louis Federal Reserve District, then what you do is you vote for, make sure I get this right, yes, you vote for one Class A member and one Class B member. Okay, so all the small banks that are in the St. Louis area and that are members of the St. Louis Federal Reserve system, I don't know what word they use, they all vote for a Class A member and a Class B member. And then the same thing if you're a medium-sized bank, and I think the size is determined by your capital, and if you're a large bank. Okay, so again, and the other reason I'm stressing it, again, it's not that this is rocket science or this is critical, but I just want to, it's hard to convey in words what this is. That's why I'm saying it a few different ways. So when all is said and done, there's three Class A board members and three Class B board members. And what I'm saying is one of them, one of the Class A ones, was elected just by the small banks in the St. Louis area that are members of the St. Louis Fed. And one of the Class B members was elected just by the small banks. And then one Class A member was elected just by the medium-sized banks. And one Class A member was elected just by the large banks. Okay, so you see how that works? Okay, so now, so if you're a small commercial bank in the St. Louis area, what ultimate influence do you have on Federal Reserve policy? Not much, because all you can do is elect you and your other small commercial banks who are members. You pick one guy who's a Class A board member and one guy who's a Class B board member. And then, you know, your influence gets diluted by all the other banks, too. So notice, too, there could be, I mean, I don't know what the distribution is in practice, but even already the way they structured this, by breaking it up by size, it's in principle, I mean, there could be 1,000 small member banks and only 5 large ones. And yet those 5 large ones would be able themselves to elect one Class A member and one Class B member, and that's the same power that the 1,000 small banks would have, ultimately, just to be able to pick one Class A and Class B. Okay, so it's kind of like electing a senator in house. Well, that's actually the opposite. Never mind. But make sure you get that point. Now, but I've just talked about so far where these Class A and Class B members come from. But remember, each of these 12 Federal Reserve District banks has 9 of them, and so a third are these Class C members. Where do they come from? They come from the Board of Governors in D.C. picks all 3 of those Class C people. So the Board of Governors in D.C. picks 1/3 of the board members for every single of the district banks, and they get even more power because now what possible influence could these district banks have on Fed policy? Well, we'll see in a few minutes. They rotate, and occasionally the president of a particular district bank will be on the FOMC, which is the body that makes Fed policy, monetary policy. So that's the only way you could ultimately influence it. So you say, oh, well, we want to make sure we get a good guy that we like, you know. So if all the small commercial banks in Alabama are totally smitten with the Mises Institute and they love Austrian economics, let's make sure that our, let's see who, what branch that would even be. Would that be? So it looks like that would be the Atlanta Fed would probably be the one that we'd be talking about. So we want to get a real good Austrian to be president of the Atlanta Fed so that when the Atlanta Fed happens to have its rotation up and they're on the FOMC, we can get somebody voting to raise interest rates or to not do quantitative easing or whatever. Well, no, because even if you did somehow get enough board members, A and B board members, to offset the C board members that the DC people put in charge of the Atlanta Fed, they can still, the Board of Governors can still has the power to approve each district bank board's pick for the district bank president. So even if somehow magically all of the large, medium, and small commercial banks in the Atlanta area were totally Austrian and they wanted to put a hard money guy as president of the Atlanta Fed, it wouldn't matter. That if the DC, if the Board of Governors in DC didn't like that guy, they could say, no, we don't approve him. All right. So now, okay, so what's the big deal about the district bank presidents? Well, you'll see, because the FOMC, the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee, is the body that in practice determines monetary policy. So when you read in the press that the Fed is meeting next Wednesday, and Wall Street's anxious to see, is the Fed going to raise interest rates or not? Or what's the statement going to be that the Fed releases? They're not talking about the Board of Governors. They're talking about the FOMC. And they're the ones who are meeting and discussing monetary policy. So what makes up the FOMC? It's the seven people that are on the Board of Governors that's based in D.C., and then it's five Reserve Bank presidents. So notice there are, at any given time, there are 12 total Reserve Bank presidents, but at any given moment, only five of them are on the FOMC. So you'll see in the press, people might talk about a Federal Reserve Bank president spouting off against Bernanke or something, and they'll say, but he's not a voting member, so who cares? This is just jawboning. So what they mean is, if it's the president of the Dallas Fed or something, let me see if I can. I think the Kansas City guy too also lately has been. So the San Francisco Fed president has been more interventionist, which isn't surprising, but. The Dallas and the Kansas City in recent past, I can remember them saying things that were not nauseating. But the issue is, are they a voting member? And then if they're not, then people don't care because they're just spouting out, they can't do anything. But if they're a voting member, what they mean is, it happens that right now their bank is one of the five that's supplementing the seven Board of Governors who are permanently on the FOMC. And that's where the, okay. So, let me just check one last thing here. Okay. So now, who are these five? So again, there's 12 on the FOMC. Seven of them are the Board of Governors that sit in Washington. And then five of them are the Reserve Bank presidents. And so now, how are those five picked? Because it's not, so the schedule's a bit interesting, and you'll see that it distributes the power unevenly again. So now we're on this bullet point. So one of the five is always the president of the New York Fed. Okay, so another way of putting it is, the president of the New York Federal Reserve District Bank is a permanent member of the FOMC. He's always a voting member. So if the president of the New York Fed starts spouting off to the press, that's a big deal because he's always a voting member. The other four slots are one-year terms, and they rotate among the remaining 11 districts. And Cleveland and Chicago have the advantage. So I didn't spell it out here in the PowerPoint, but if you go and look at the assigned readings for this week, you'll see they group them. So of the remaining 11, trying to say this with an economy of words here, so now we're looking again at this map. So the point is the New York Fed, this is my pointer here, the New York Fed is always on it. And so now we got four slots for any given year and who's going to fill it up. And what I'm saying is of the remaining 11, they put them into different groups, some of which have three banks in them. And so then in that group, one year it's the one bank, the next year it's another bank, the next year it's the third bank, the next year it goes back to the first one, right? So it rotates among those three that are in that bucket. But the Cleveland and Chicago banks are the only two in their bucket. So I'm backing up here. See how Cleveland and Chicago are right near each other? So those two, so every year it's either Chicago or Cleveland's president is on the FOMC. And then the next year it goes back to the other guy. And so you see what I'm saying? So if you're the president of the Chicago Fed, every other year you're going to be a voting member. Whereas if you're the president, let's say, of the Minneapolis Fed, you're only going to be a voting member every third year because you're in a group that has three total banks that has to share the one-year term appointments. So I hope that made sense. So another way of thinking of it is New York is in a bucket all by itself. So it rotates, but it's the only one in there. So every year, oh, it's me again. Great, good, because I have some things to say. Whereas Chicago and Cleveland are in a bucket with just the two of them, so every other year it's them. And then all the other nine are broken up into three different groups of three banks apiece, and it goes among them. So you can see, again, the power that is given to the big boys in the financial sector, since New York is the biggest, and then Chicago is the second biggest in terms of financial center in the country. So why is Cleveland in there? I'm not sure. Maybe just because they didn't want to make Chicago. I'm totally speculating right now. So clearly you understand why New York is so privileged. But why is Cleveland, like, why didn't they make it Chicago and Minneapolis or Chicago and Kansas City or Chicago and San Fran, for that example, or for that matter? And it may just be, it would be too weird to make Chicago and San Francisco in the same block. And but they wanted to not give Chicago the same amount of power as New York. So maybe it was just, they said, well, we got to group Chicago with one other bank. Let's pick Cleveland. I don't know why they pick Cleveland. Like, it's not like I think of Cleveland as being a financial powerhouse. Okay, did I finish this slide? Okay, and so then the last thing on this FOMC slide is since 1981, they have 8 regularly scheduled meetings per year. And they will meet. They can call emergency meetings, like if something's going on and then the next meeting, you know, in terms of the 8 that are regularly scheduled, if that's not going to occur for a while, they can convene an emergency session and decide what to do. But the point is, even if just normal things are happening, they meet 8 times a year regularly just to update their statement about Fed policy, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so this question of who owns the Fed, this is one of those things where, like I said when I was talking to you guys last time about the rhetoric behind it and how certain arguments are very appealing to some people more so than economic analyses of the harm of low interest rates and that kind of stuff. And remember I said that when I was younger, I was surprised that Rothbard spent so much time in his case against the Fed talking about the history and the personalities involved and all the dubious things they were doing, because I thought, well, that's just trivia. Tell me why a central bank is bad in theory. That even if it were run by angels, why is it bad? Because I know that an Austrian can make that case and that Rothbard believes that. So you know, something analogous to Mises' argument against socialism, Mises didn't spend a lot of time detailing all the people that Stalin butchered. Instead, Mises was saying, let's concede that the central planner is perfectly benevolent, has nothing but the welfare of his citizens and his subjects in his heart, and let's concede that all, everybody listens to them, there's no corruption, but still this fundamental economic calculation problem. That's what I expected Rothbard to do in the case against the Fed. And he did give that. That argument is in there, but that was like in the second half of the book. The first half was talking about these shady characters who were doing stuff behind the scenes. Like I said, that surprised me, but now I think I understand why he did that, because for some reason with the general public, their ears will perk up about that, and they'll care about actual people behind the scenes, rich people doing stuff and lying to the public, and then that taints anything that they do publicly. And so if Rothbard can show that, look, if the Fed was not founded by a bunch of disinterested academics, no, it was founded by these bankers behind the scenes who were clearly covering their tracks, what do you think of that? And a lot of people are going to say, oh, maybe I don't like this Federal Reserve. So where am I going with this refresher about what I said last time is that this issue of who owns the Fed really resonates with some people. And to give you an example, so I live in Nashville, and this was back when, if you guys remember, I'm trying to remember, was there something going on? I can't remember what the event was that made us do it, but there was this end the Fed stuff was really going on, and there were like campaigns around the country and marches on Federal Reserve banks. So we went down to, it had the word Federal Reserve on it, but it obviously wasn't a district headquarters, because it's not that Nashville has one. But whatever the thing was that we were protesting in front of, we all lined up, and there was like, I don't know, 30 of us. And I'm trying to look like I'm cool, because these are all college kids or people like that, hippie people. And so I didn't go in a shirt and tie. I went like in shorts and had some kind of big jungle hat on or something, because it was really hot that day. And we have a loudspeaker, and we're just like, you know, activism, man, fight the power, that kind of stuff. And I'm trying to rally the troops and get everyone all fired up against fractional reserve banking and all that stuff. But anyway, the point of my story is, the people, one of the college kids, I mean, people had made signs. And so we were trying to make a rally. We were trying to, like, make a statement, and maybe the news media would show up or something. And unfortunately, not enough of us showed up that nobody cared. But cars would be driving by, and we'd be looking at our signs. And one of the signs that this kid drew said, the Fed is a private institution with private shareholders. And that was in other words, when he was thinking, what do I want to communicate to the public, he didn't want to say the Fed is fostering an unsustainable boom. He didn't want to say the Fed is causing a mismatch between capital goods prices and consumer preferences. Or, you know what I mean? He didn't say, oh, the Fed's reducing actual interest rates below the natural rate, as Vic Sell would have described it. He didn't say that stuff. He said the Fed is owned by private shareholders, and he thought that was going to cause traffic accidents. So that's why I'm partly talking about this, because I'll go give talks at places, and people will come up to me and will say, yeah, I liked everything you said, talking about the dangers of low interest rate policies, blah, 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 but you missed the big story. And I'm like, oh, what's the big story? And they'll say that people think the Fed is like the EPA, and it's not. The Fed is a private organization owned by bankers, and you need to tell people that. Okay, so anyway, for whatever reason, and by the way, I'm not making fun of those people or that viewpoint. I'm just saying there is a subset of the people who hate the Federal Reserve, and the reason they hate it is because they hate commercial bankers, and they see that the Fed is a creature of the commercial bankers. And it's not being used to oppress the bankers, it's being used to enrich them. And so that's what horrifies them more than anything else. They don't really get into the details of Austrian business cycle theory. It's not that they don't care about it, that's sort of an academic thing. For them, it's, wait a minute, these guys are ripping us off, and the Fed is their vehicle for doing it. Okay, so who owns the Fed? So it is true that the member banks technically own the Federal Reserve, right? So the Federal Reserve structure system is owned by those 12 Federal Reserve District banks. So each of those banks, well, I said that a little bit misleadingly. The Fed is composed of the 12 Federal Reserve District banks, and each of those things is a corporation that has shareholders. All right, so that right there shows you the Fed is different from the IRS or the EPA or the Department of Education. The Department of Education is not a corporation. It's like you can go and buy stock in the Department of Education. Whereas there are, well, move on. Okay, so then you say, well, who owns these corporations? Like, are they listed on the New York Stock Exchange? If I want to, can I go short the St. Louis Fed? Or can I go long on the San Fran Fed? Well, no, because the way you get stock is you're a member bank. So I remember before I was saying if you're a commercial bank in the St. Louis area, you either are or are not part of the St. Louis Federal Reserve District. And so what does it mean to be a member bank? Well, if you're a member bank, you purchase stock in that bank equal to 3% of your own capital, fixed at $100 per share. And then technically, if the Fed wants, it can ask you to pump in 3% more. All right, so you're giving money to the Federal Reserve District Bank in exchange for you then owning shares in it, but the shares don't fluctuate on the market. It's not that they're actively traded. They are fixed at $100 per share. All right. Then you say, okay, that's interesting. So what's the extent of this membership in the Fed system? Well, when I made this slide, I didn't check to see what the numbers had changed. When I made the slide as of early 2011, the number at that point was 38%. So of all the banks in the United States, 38% of them, as of early 2011, were officially members of the Federal Reserve System, meaning they had bought into and owned stock in their particular Federal Reserve District Bank. And it's a requirement that all so-called national banks must be. So the point, if you're just a regional commercial bank and you just do business in one city or something like that, you don't have to be a member of the Federal Reserve System if you don't want to. I mean, you're still subject to its regulations. I mean, they can still regulate you. It's not like you can do whatever the heck you want because, hey, I'm outside the system. But the point is you don't have to buy into it. You don't have to literally buy into it. You can buy into it intellectually, of course. But if you're a national bank, then you have no choice. You have to buy stock in the Federal Reserve System. And they get a fixed 6% dividend on their stock. So in other words, for every share that they own, the Fed gives them $6 a year out of the Fed's general earnings. So that's the sense in which you could say, oh yeah, the Fed is a private institution. It's literally owned by people in the private sector. That's interesting. But then I say sort of, meaning it's not like it's Google. Okay, so why is that? Okay, for one thing, the stock shares are adjusted with the bank size to maintain the 3% of the capital rule. So if you're, when you bought in, you know, let's say you were worth $100 million, that was your capital, and you decided to buy into the St. Louis Federal Reserve System, so then you put in $3 million and then got, 30,000 shares, am I doing the math right? Then you grow. Well, you're going to kick in more money, right? So it's got to be the case that at any given time, you have shares valued at a fixed $100 per share equal to 3% of your commercial bank's capital. So that's odd. That, you know, that's like a normal corporate. If you buy stock in Google, it's not like if you get richer, you have to buy more stock of Google, right? Whereas that's kind of what's going on here. Another thing is, yeah, you're a shareholder, but the Fed stock can't serve as collateral. So if you're a commercial bank and you own stock in the Federal Reserve System, it's not like you can go to some lender and say, hey, I'm hard up for cash right now, give me $1 million, and do I have assets? Yeah, I own a bunch of stock in the Federal Reserve. That's, you know, you don't want to, that's a pretty good asset, don't you think? You can't do that. Another thing is, it's not that it's one, it's not as you get one vote for every share of stock the way it would be in a standard corporation. It's, remember, there was that complicated thing where you're classified with your peers according to your size. And so that's weird. And that I also talked extensively already about how the true power lies with the Board of Governors, which in turn, the head of that is appointed by the President and confirmed by the Senate. Okay, so my point is, yes, the Federal Reserve is a privately owned corporation, but it's quite different from any other corporation. So it's true, the Fed is not analogous to the Treasury or the Environmental Protection Agency or the IRS or the Department of Education. The Fed is really distinct from those kind of agencies. But on the other hand, I think it's misleading when some people say, oh, the Fed's a private corporation, and make it sound like the Fed was this private thing that then hijacked Washington. That's not what it was. No, Washington created the Fed and cartelized the banks and then made it very easy for the banks to benefit from it, but Washington controls it. So I don't mean to be naive. Don't get me wrong. I do think that if you ask who are some of the most powerful people on planet Earth, I don't think it's President Obama and Sarkozy. I think, you know, there are bankers and media moguls and people like that that actually are more powerful, because President Obama, no one's going to care what he thinks 10 years from now, whereas Rupert Murdoch is going to have a lot of influence 10 years from now. And, you know, the people who are the major shareholders in global banks are going to still have a ton of power 5 years from now, whereas Obama's not, probably, unless he gets reelected and then gets away with the two terms for U.S. presidents. All right, so what I mean is, personally, I think it's kind of a red herring to focus on this issue so much. So, yeah, it's interesting to bring up, especially because it resonates with a lot of people. And just if you're dealing with a so-called progressive, somebody who thinks of him or herself as a progressive and thinks we need powerful institutions in D.C. to beat down the evil business people who are out there to get us, and that we need strong regulators, it's interesting to point out to somebody like that, like, look at how the Fed is set up. Are you kidding me? You really think? I mean, it is literally owned by bankers who have some say in who ends up sitting on the board that then regulate them. I mean, somebody once wrote a thing, an analogy saying, if the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, if it were run like the Fed, it would be like all of the, agricultural companies and all the food, you know, General Mills and Archer, Daniels Mills, or whatever that's ADM, and all these guys, you know, all these big companies got together, and then they voted on the board members and the regulatory people who then staffed the FDA, that then turned around and laid out food safety regulations on them. and, you know, and all the pharmaceutical companies got together and had a major say in the people that then regulated them. I mean, that would be that kind of the system that there is right now, but it's more subtle than that. Whereas with the Fed, it is nakedly in your face. The bankers have a lot to do with the people that are then going to turn around and regulate them. And so my point is, if you're of the mindset that we need a strong central government, including the Federal Reserve, to keep us safe from these laissez-faire businessmen, if you look at the actual structure of the Fed, you can kind of say to the person, are you kidding me? You really think that's going to work? So that's, I think, the only use of really delving into this stuff, because in general, the banks do not control the Fed directly. The way they would control the Fed is if the bankers actually fund presidential campaigns and control the media and ultimately determine who the president is. And then they could tell the president, yeah, this guy Bernanke's okay, he plays ball. This other guy, you know, don't make him the Fed chief because we're not sure he's going to do things to our liking. And so, you know, put this guy Bernanke up there because he's a tool. He'll do whatever we tell him to do. So that's, in other words, I'm saying if you're of a conspiratorial mindset, I think that's the way you would want to think about it. Not that because the member banks can pick the Class A and Class B members if they really wanted to. I mean, that's their power is very diluted officially. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the Fed-Treasury relationship, because this is a subtle thing. Incidentally, I don't know if you guys have seen this. I just noticed this the other night. Doesn't it look like in this picture that the carpet there is folded? So I'm just, you know, what if the emperor trips and breaks his leg? I mean, somebody's going to die. So anyway, I noticed that. Okay, senior rich. This is a word that you don't want to have to spell this in a spelling bee because you're probably going to get it wrong. So what this means is, just think of it as how the government makes money from its monopoly. I'll just say monop because I'm not sure if that's going to get cut off. Okay, so that's that chicken scratch there in my writing says how government makes money from its monopoly. So back when you had a commodity money, one way you could do it is just, and this is historically how it was done when this term was invented, the government, I'm just making this up, of course, in practice, things would be different historically depending on what country you're talking about, but originally in the free market, we've talked about how money could arise, commodity money, so people are using gold and silver, let's say. But even there, there's a role for there to be coins, you know, to have something more official, because you don't want to have to, if you're a merchant and gold is the money in your community and somebody comes in and wants to buy something that is 2.5 ounces of gold, and the person says, okay, so here's a chunk of metal, and it's gold, and look at that weighs 2.2 ounces, and then here, let me give you a hunk of silver, and I think that's the balance, and so there, I can walk out with this thing. Now, you got to test the thing, you got to weigh it, you know what I'm saying? It's a pain, and then when you're done, you've got these hunks of metal, right? So that's kind of a pain, and so you don't want every merchant having to do that with every customer. So once again, market forces come to the rescue, and you can have private mints, M-I-N-T-S. And their business is people go in, give them hunks of metal, and they turn it into coins. Or the mints go out on the market and buy wholesale a bunch of metal from mining operations. And then they'll get shipped in a ton of, like literally tons of gold or silver and stamp them into coins. And of course, what would make one mint prosperous and another mint go out of business is that you want these coins to be very usable. Like, so you don't want to make a coin that's the size of a manhole cover and say, hey, if you want to buy a house, just roll one of these things up. And that's very inconvenient. No one wants to carry around something like that in a wheelbarrow. On the other hand, you don't want to make something so small that you're going to lose it, you know, on the sink. So they got to make coins that are of convenient sizes. You want to make them so they're differentiable, right? You don't want the coins to look the same and, like, people get confused when they're making change. You want them to be hard to counterfeit, and you want them to be very durable so that somebody can't just scrape it and take some of the gold off and pass it off as an authentic full-body coin, right? So there's lots of – and then on top of that, too, you'd want ornamental – you'd want it to look nice, just like, you know, Apple computers look snazzy, and that's partly what their appeal is, right? And George Selgin actually has a great lecture he gave at the Mises Institute talking about historically private mints and how they operated. And he had slides of the coins that these private companies produced, and they were beautiful. Right? So that's just another example of, you say, what has government done to our money? Among all the other things, money right now is tacky. It's not pretty. It is like the PC of money compared to, you know, what a Macintosh looks like or something. All right? So where was I going with it? Oh. So one of the things the government could do is come in and monopolize the issue of notes and coins. And so now, so if you think about it, why would a mint, sorry, let me back up a second. Why would a private mint do that? You might say, how could you make money just taking in sort of hunks of gold and turning them into coins of gold? Where's the money in that? Well, because there would be a spread that you would, again, I'm just making numbers up. But you might take in, you might buy 1,000 ounces of gold. This is a little bit tricky how to express this. At a discount, right? So you, in other words, in the marketplace, if you had an actual coin that was 1 ounce of gold, that would have a higher purchasing power than if you had a hunk of yellow metal that was also an ounce. And if you just think through, that would have to be the case. And he said, why would that happen? Isn't an ounce of gold not? No, because the merchant would rather get paid in a well-recognized coin, because then he doesn't have to pull out a scale and pull out testing equipment and, you know, prod it and stuff like that to make sure it's the real deal if you give him a hunk of metal. If you give him this coin that's stamped and hammered by the mint company that he's familiar with. Okay, so it depends on the convention how that would be. Probably what it would be is prices would be quoted in terms of the coin, and then if you tried to pay with a big hunk of metal, it would get discounted. The merchant would say, well, if you're trying to pay with that, I'm going to charge you a 5% premium or something. You get what I'm saying. So because of that spread then between the raw metal and the coined metal, that's how the mint would operate. That would be its margin. Okay, so the government then could come in and monopolize that industry. And now the government says it is illegal. Your private companies are not allowed to take yellow hunks of metal and turn them into coins. That's our job. Or we'll designate certain companies and give them a monopoly privilege. And so now, by eliminating competition, what happens? That spread increases. So now the spread between the purchasing power of what 1 ounce of gold gets you when it's in coin form versus if you're just using hunks of metal widens. Just like whenever a monopoly is introduced by coercion from the government stamping out competition, the margins for that industry go up. Right? This is standard economics. Okay, so so how that could manifest itself is if you go to the government and turn in hunks of yellow metal and then they give you coins in exchange, or if they give you notes that are perfectly secure claims on that, they're earning a margin. It's like a bid-ask spread, if you know what that term means. It's kind of like that. So that's what this term seigniorage means. So so the government now has an extra revenue stream every year because of its monopoly of the issue of money. Okay, so that exists to this day. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that in a few minutes here, but I just wanted to lay the groundwork to show you what that was historically. It's really easy to think about in terms of commodity money. You can understand where that distinction is coming in. It's harder to see it. Let me do this for you. Suppose now we've got fiat money, and we've just got a king, and he's made a monopoly of the note issue in his country. And he says, the only thing that can be used as money are these pieces of paper that have my picture on them. So, you know, I'm King Edward, and everyone's got to pay in terms of Edwards. And that's it. And if I catch you trying to pay somebody in gold or silver or some note issued by Citibank, I'm going to cut your head off. Okay, so everyone's using Edwards now. Everyone quotes prices in Edwards. And he has his printing press, and the Edwards not backed up by anything. So he can run the printing press to pay his bills. So it's not like he's unlimitedly wealthy, right? He can't buy planet Earth with that, because if he prints too many Edwards, the purchasing power of one Edward goes down. And so, you know, he's not omnipotent just because he has this monopoly on fiat money. But the point is that gives him a margin to acquire goods and services that he otherwise would not have. So that would be another way of seeing very starkly how a government could earn seigniorage if it just literally is running a printing press. So you could see in real terms the amount of goods and services that King Edward is able to command in the marketplace above and beyond his tax revenues, or, you know, whatever the tributes are coming from his subjects. He wants to spend more than that. I can't raise taxes because the people will revolt. I can't ask the nobles to contribute more. I have my lands, and the people farming them send me their tribute, blah, blah, blah. But I want to start a war. I'm going to pay these soldiers. I don't have enough money. Oh, I know. I'll run the printing press off and print some more Edwards, and I'll pay him in those. So that's the source. You know, he's enhanced his ability to command goods and services. And you say, oh, clearly because of his control of the money supply. Okay. Is there something like that that operates now with the Federal Reserve and the way it operates with the Treasury? Yes, but it's really complicated. So let me just walk through the basics of it. Okay, so first of all, the Fed earns interest income on its assets. It's pretty easy to do because the Federal Reserve, remember, has the legal ability to create bank reserves out of thin air. If the Fed wants to go buy $1 billion in bonds, it can do that. And you say, oh, does it have enough money? Yeah, it has an unlimited amount of money. The Fed just writes a check on itself, gives it to the bond dealer. The bond dealer delivers the $1 billion worth of bonds. The Fed puts those on its assets. And then, oh, yeah, its liabilities go up. But what does that mean? It just means now there's $1 billion more out there where commercial banks now say, oh, we have reserves on deposit with the Fed. But since the dollar's not backed up by anything, it's not like Bernanke's worried, uh-oh, what if they show up and want to withdraw their money? He's fine. He'll just tell the Bureau of Printing and Engraving, print up $1 billion in currency and hand it to them. So, I mean, in terms of bookkeeping operations, the Fed's assets are matched by liabilities when they do that kind of thing, but there's no real constraint the way there would be if there were still a gold standard. If there were still a gold standard and somebody showed up with $1 billion and said, give me the gold at $35 an ounce, then Bernanke had better have 1 billion divided by 35 ounces of gold somewhere to hand to those people, or else it's going to, you know, default. But there's no problem about that now. All right, so the Fed now has a big balance sheet, has all these assets that it owns. And what do? They yield an income. If you buy a bond, if it's a long-term one, it probably pays interest at regular intervals, or if it's a short-term security, then maybe you just buy it at a discount, and then it matures at its face value, and then you get that back. So you're getting back more money than you paid for it. So that's where your interest income comes from. But either way, the point is the Fed's got this income that it's earning. Just like if you're a household and you save and buy bonds, you earn an income, interest income. All right, so what did the Fed do with this? Okay, well, it has expenses. It's got to pay the janitor. It's got to pay people to maintain its the website, the Fred database and all that. It's got to pay people to do that stuff. It's got to give money to academics who write research papers, and they say, you know, I work for the Federal Reserve, or this paper was made possible by a grant from the St. Louis Fed or whatever. So they have expenses. They have to pay their electric bill and so forth. But after that, we also know, remember, they pay the 6% dividend to their member banks that we talked about. Because the banks, to be a member, had to kick in at least 3% of their capital, and they earn a fixed 6% on that. So that number, the latest report, is for calendar 2009, and that number happened to be $1.5 billion. Then, well, you know what? I wonder, I think that's probably a typo. I think I probably should have put 2010 there. Because I got that in the same place I got this. So not a big deal, but I think that was probably for 2010. But they still have tons of money left over. And then what do they do with it? They give it to the Treasury. So this, the verb they use is they remit it. And so in 2010, that number happened to be $79.3 billion. So again, what that means is the Fed can buy assets just by writing checks on itself. The checks cannot bounce legally. The Fed always has money available because it creates it out of thin air. Those assets then yield a big income. Lately, that income has been enormous because the Fed has bought a bunch of assets lately. The Fed's balance sheet has more than tripled in the last 4 years. So if you're sitting on something like over $2 trillion in assets, you're going to have a sizable interest income on those things. After paying its expenses, after paying the dividend to member banks, it was left with $79.3 billion. And what did it do? It hands it over to the Treasury. Okay, and then I show you, here, if you want to go see where these numbers come from, it's from here if you're curious. Now so you can kind of start to see, let me put it this way, you understand what's in it for the bankers. You know, why would the bankers want to have a Federal Reserve System? It seems crazy. Why would you want this institution that regulates them and tells them what they can and can't do? Well, we've seen because it's a cartel device. It beat down the checks upon fractional reserve banking that the market would have established, and so it allows the big banks to all come together and inflate in unison and to keep out new entrants who would then undercut them and offer a higher reserve ratio and gradually drain them of their reserves. All right, so it's a big cartel. And then, of course, the other huge benefit is and why it promotes lower reserve ratios than would happen in a market is if a particular bank gets in trouble, the Fed can come in and bail it out in the sense of just lending it money. So banks don't need to worry about illiquidity anymore. They still need to worry about insolvency, but liquidity is not an issue if you have a central bank. So we see why big Wall Street banks who know that they're going to be hand in glove with the central government and are going to have a lot to do with the people that are actually running the Fed, we can see why they would want the Fed to exist. But why would the government want the Fed to exist? Well, we see already one thing that, well, they earn a healthy income from that institution. And so, again, just 30,000-foot view, of course the government benefits by being able to control the money supply, by having a monopoly on that. And I told you, it's a commodity money, if they monopolize that, you can see how they expand the spread between what the raw metal gets you and what the coins get you, or the notes that are backed up by coin. And if it's just pure printing press, you understand how that works. But in our modern system, the federal government can't just run the printing press. That's not how it works. So it's not the case that if the federal budget deficit is $800 billion, they don't just go to the Fed and say, fire up the printing press, give us $800 billion, and we're going to pay our bills with that. That's not how it happens. Technically, the federal government, the United States government, the U.S. Treasury, when they run a deficit, they have to issue bonds or notes or T-bills and things like that, securities more generally. So they have to borrow money just like a company would. But the thing is, to the extent that those treasury securities end up on the Fed's balance sheet, the interest that Geithner pays on those treasury securities comes right back to the treasury. So this $79.3 billion, that's not like a gift to the government, and it's like, oh, this is more money for us to spend. That's just giving the government its own money back, right? Because where did that $79.3 billion come from? It largely came from the interest that the Treasury itself, out of tax revenue, paid to the owners of its securities, a lot of which were owned by the Fed itself, right? So that's one thing. But to the extent that the Fed's earnings come from assets outside of government bonds, then that really is a pure gift to the federal government. So that's one reason that I think in this crisis they wanted to use it to break the tradition where the central bank just buys government bonds, which is what it used to be. Whereas now they're buying mortgage-backed securities, they're buying all kinds of stuff. There's various things going on, and when we get to the lecture in 2 weeks on unconventional operations, we'll talk more about it. But one thing about it that's interesting right now to point out is if the Fed goes and buys assets that are not issued by the federal government, then notice the income it earns on those flows to the government, and that is a separate source of revenue, free and clear, whereas the other way, it's just kind of returning the interest payment that the Treasury gave the Fed through the front door, it's through the back door, giving it right back to them. So effectively what that means is, okay, so here, monetizing the debt, this is where I'm talking about, where I already addressed a lot of these points. So we saw how a king would monetize the debt, meaning he would just run the printing press. This is a different slide. So what the Fed does right now in the Treasury, it's a complicated thing, but technically the Treasury runs a deficit. The Fed might take those bonds onto its balance sheet. The Treasury then pays interest on them out of tax collections. That money goes to the Fed, and most of it the Fed hands right back to the Treasury. So really what happens is it's that when the federal government wants to run a deficit, when it wants to spend more than it has in tax revenue, the Fed effectively creates that money out of thin air, hands it to the Treasury so they can spend it. Well, it doesn't have, it lends it to them basically at 0% interest, even back when interest rates were higher. So what I'm saying right now is not just because interest rates right now are low. This is in general. Whatever the interest payment is, the Fed turns around and gives most of it right back. So it's basically an interest-free loan. So already you can see how it's getting close to what our hypothetical king would do when he would just run the printing press to pay the army. And so the one difference is you could say, wait a minute, though, but the Fed still has the principal, right, that these bonds are piling up. But as long as the Fed just keeps rolling those over, the Treasury never actually has to pay that debt off. And so if you think of it that way, if you're the government now and you've got the central bank that's in the wings, and you know whenever you need to run a deficit, even if your own people, even if the international capital markets, other governments, if they don't want to lend you any more money because they think you're a credit risk, if you know you can count on your central bank to buy your debt indirectly, they don't buy it at auction, they buy it in the secondary market, but because they're willing to do that, people in the primary market are willing to lend you money. So as long as the Fed's willing to soak up that debt, give you the interest payments right back as you make them, And you know they're never going to call that debt. They're never going to dump those bonds, or they're never just going to let them mature and say, yeah, we're going to shrink our balance sheet. Why don't you pay us off? You know, these notes and bills and so forth come due, you're going to pay us, and then we're not going to buy new bonds. Then if you think they're never going to do that, that the balance of what they hold is going to keep growing, then that is effectively the same thing as monetizing the debt. That's effectively the same thing as saying, we have an $800 billion deficit this year, just fire up the printing press and pay for it. Because they have still created the money out of thin air that actually goes out the door. And yeah, technically they're holding bonds that, you know, yield 5% interest, but they give you the interest payment right back, and they're never going to want the principal to be repaid. So if they were doing that literally, it's the same thing as the medieval king who just runs the printing press. Okay, who owns the debt? I don't know if you can see this, but this right here is what's called intra-governmental debt holdings, so meaning agencies of the federal government, like certain pension funds and things, and primarily the so-called trust funds of Social Security and Medicare. You can see they hold like about $4.6 trillion as of these numbers. These numbers were garnered from different sources. So it's some of them are more like 2011, some are more like early 2012. But they're all generally the same time frame for when these numbers were taken. Whereas the Fed, it's like $1.6 trillion. All right, and so you can see, like, the Federal Reserve holds more securities issued by the Treasury than everybody in China or than everybody in Japan and so forth. So it's like the Fed is this big country that invests a lot in U.S. government debt. And just like it would be a serious event if the Chinese finance minister said, we're dumping all of our bonds that Uncle Sam issued, it would be pretty catastrophic if the Federal Reserve all of a sudden said, yeah, you know what, we don't think the Treasury is a good credit risk anymore. But probably that's not going to happen. Okay, we're running out of time here. Let me just talk about the Federal Reserve's the thing that comes out every Thursday afternoon typically is this H4-1 statistical release factors affecting reserve balances. And I say here it's not a true balance sheet, but if you want to see the actual balance sheet, that's something else. You go to the link. It's called How to Read the Fed's Balance Sheet. It's in this week 5 list of readings. And then you go to Table 8. And that this consolidated statement of condition of all Federal Reserve banks. And that is literally a balance sheet. So it shows you all the assets of the Federal Reserve banks consolidated, obviously, so it doesn't break it out by like St. Louis or San Fran. And then all their liabilities. And so you can go there if you're just curious to see what does the Fed's balance sheet look like. That's the thing you'd want to look at. Okay, last thing here. Let me just spend I'll spend like 2 minutes on this and then go to your guys' questions. And we'll go 5 minutes over, let's say that. So I'll go 5 past the hour, and then if I don't answer your questions, I'll get them on the, you know, typing them out. But this thing was interesting, this accounting rule change. Oops, I lost my... All right, so what this is, and the reason I'm stressing this is because it kind of links all the stuff that we've been talking about. So if you want to, the thing I'm going to talk about here, if you really want to see more, I have a Mises.org article called Accentuate the Positive. So if you Google, you know, Robert Murphy, Mises.org, Accentuate the Positive, that should come up. Or just do Fed accounting rule change, Robert Murphy, Mises.org, it'll come up. Because the thing is that accentuate, they broke it up to have the word cent standing apart. So that particular word might not, Google might not catch that. But if that article, I walked through this really slowly, let me just give you the highlights right now. So, and again, because now that you've taken this class up to this point, you're in a position to really understand how interesting this is. So January 6th, 2011, this standard H401 release that comes out every week that, you know, just gives, oh, this week reserve balances went up this amount because of blah, 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 and they went down, you know, and they just, it's real dry stuff. And just, you know, mind-numbing, okay. And they had this statement about how they were going to, what they were going to do with the Fed's earnings. And so they made it look, in the treatment, and I really show, like I quote from it and show you and walk through carefully in this article I mentioned, but the if you read it carefully, or sorry, if you read it quickly, they made it sound like they were just talking about, hey, we have all this income we're earning, and what are we going to do with it? Well, we know that ultimately we got to give it to the Treasury. So instead of us first listing it as part of our capital and then transferring it, we'll just skip the middleman. We'll just right away list it as a liability. Okay, because remember the Fed's balance sheet, you've got your assets on the left side. On the right side, you've got liability and then capital, or liability and shareholder equity. And so they're saying, we've got all these, you know, positive earnings coming in that's raising the value of our assets, like if bonds are maturing, their market value is going up, and then we got to give those earnings to the Treasury. So instead of us first showing the rise in asset value by a rise in our capital without our liability changing, and then we do some sort of reckoning at the end of the fiscal period and say, oh, since we made $50 million, that's $50 million now more, we're going to remit to the Treasury, and then you would just, on the right-hand side, you bump up your liabilities and lower the capital, right? Because you know, the left-hand side is not going to change initially. You want to change the right-hand side. So instead of them doing that, they just said, "What is market right? You know, the increase in the asset value. What is market right in the liabilities? And we'll just show we owe the Treasury more money for this period." Okay, so that seems okay. Fine, whatever. And they did it in a real dry technical jargon that, you know, put most of you to sleep, put most of you in a coma. A few weeks went by, and then some financial bloggers were like, wait a second, you know what that means? The Fed can't go bankrupt now. No matter what happens, it is impossible for the Fed to become insolvent. And what would happen is the consequence of this rule change that they made, because again, they were making it sound like, when our assets go up, how are we going to reflect that and how much more we're going to pay the Treasury that year? But the interesting ramification of the rule change was, suppose the assets went down. Well, normally what you would do in standard accounting is a change in your assets isn't going to affect your liabilities. It's not that the people you owe money to, you're not going to owe them less because the thing you invested in tanked. What's going to happen is, your assets minus your liabilities now is going to be smaller when your assets fall, so your capital is going to go down. And if that happens too much, if your assets fall too much relative to your liabilities, then you go bankrupt. You're insolvent. If your assets become less than your liabilities, you have negative equity. And that's what insolvency is. But with this rule change, what would happen is if the Fed's assets went down by $30 billion, they wouldn't have their capital go down $30 billion. They would now show that they owed the Treasury negative $30 billion. And so that's the way they would have changes in the left-hand side of the balance sheet match up with changes in the right-hand side. But if you think about that, what the heck is a negative liability? It doesn't even make any sense. It's to say, I owe someone negative money. It's like they owe you money. And so way that how that would play out then, it's like they were taking a loan from the Treasury and saying, you know, normally if we're all square with the Treasury and we earn income, we got to remit it to you guys. But now if our assets took a $30 billion hit, okay, right now we're saying we owe you negative $30 billion. So now from this point forward, if we start earning income and we normally would be paying you, money would be going out the door to the Treasury. First, we're not going to send you anything. You have to work off this $30 billion that you owe us. Or really, we are going to keep paying you, but since right now our liability to you is negative $30 billion, like if we were normally going to send you a check for $1 billion, now we're not going to send you anything. We're just going to say on our books, we owe you negative $29 billion. And then, oh, we earned some more interest income on our assets. We normally would give you $1 billion. We're not going to send you anything. Now we owe you $28 billion, or negative $28 billion. All right, so you see how that works? So, but at any given time now, no matter what happens to the Fed's assets, they can't be insolvent because their assets, their capital will always be positive. Because if their assets go down, they make their liabilities go down because they have this negative number that's in there. And so when you add up all the liabilities, there's this big negative number that brings the total down. So assets are always going to be, if assets fall $30 billion, so will liabilities. Because they'll just reflect that on the right-hand side of the balance sheet by putting in a negative $30 billion owed to the Treasury. Okay, so I got to stop there with this stuff just because I want to have a few minutes for your questions. But if you understand general accounting, the notion of reflecting a fall in assets by entering a negative liability to somebody that you normally would give your positive earnings to is crazy if you think through the ramifications. And so we don't know if that's why they did it. It's conceivable they made this rule change for some other reason, and this was just some quirk that, hey, look. But the point is people think, are suspicious, that they did this because they're sitting on so many assets right now, so many bonds that they bought when interest rates were at historically low levels. If price inflation starts taking off and they decide they need to raise interest rates, that's going to really hurt the market value of the Fed assets, right? Because when interest rates go up, the market value of bonds goes down. And so if you're sitting on $2 trillion worth of bonds and interest rates go from 0% to 8%, you're going to get crushed. And so some of us were speculating maybe they got their ducks in a row so that in case they have to do that, it's not going to be this awkward situation where the Fed's equity is negative $30 billion and any other institution would be shut down. And they're going to have to explain why it's okay for them to be insolvent, technically. So anyway, that's the issue. Okay. Unfortunately, I took longer than I intended, so let me just answer one question, and I'll let you guys go, and I'll catch the rest on the forum. Okay, Susan Davidson says, general comment for your thoughts. Reading The Creature from Jekyll Island, the bankers receive bailout upon bailout upon bailout. It is never ending, and J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, etc., get fined upon fine for breaking the law, and it goes on and on. Why? It seems much worse than facing organized crime. Got cut off. Okay. Yes, that's right. My guess is, and right now even, you know, the government is hauling all these executives in front of it, and NPR and all these things are having a big field day about, oh my gosh, the bankers are getting in trouble now, and why is that, or how do we reconcile that with the story of the federal government set up this institution, the Federal Reserve, that funneled all this income and privilege and cartel privileges to these big bankers? I think one thing for sure is they have to keep up appearances, right? So the federal government has to posture and make it look like they're cracking down on these Wall Street fat cats. Just because all kinds of egregious stuff is happening, and so the federal government has to make the public think the federal government is doing its job in punishing these people. The other thing, too, is it's not just this real simplistic relationship. Everybody, and these powerful people are always vying for advantage and power and so forth. So the existence of the Fed helps both the bankers and Washington. So it's not like the bankers just totally took over D.C. and created the Fed, and now all the politicians are totally powerless and subservient to them. I mean, it's a complicated symbiotic thing where the general public is the host, and these guys are parasites, if you want to think of it that way. And they're just vying for jockeying for position in the hierarchy of who's going to get the most loot. One last thing is they can use these scandals to get the public to go along with granting the federal government more power, which it can then use to further cartelize the system. So it's ironically in the big banker's interest in the long run to get called in front of Congress and have a bunch of guys wag their fingers at them and lash out, and they pay a $50 million fine or whatever when they're making $10 billion a quarter or whatever their numbers are. It then, the public outrage, allows the government to pass some new thing that lays a bunch more regulatory requirements on all the banks, so now it's even that much harder for a mid-level bank to compete with J.P. Morgan. Right? So I think that's the kind of way to interpret the things that are happening. Okay, well, let me stop there. I'll let you guys go. I'll post your quiz by Thursday. And just next week, we're going to get into conventional open market operations.